Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the December 2025 issue. First up, Growing Pains, Daycare's Affordability Crisis, by Lauren Hilgers. Months before there was a preschool along FM 969, a swollen farm-to-market road on the outskirts of Austin, Texas, there was a sign. Pasted on either side of a wooden billboard in front of a faded red brick church, the advertisement stood next to a grassy ditch and a few cracked squares of sidewalk that led nowhere in particular. The joyful child, it read, in a rope of white cursive script, Child Care for Everyone. The sign was the work of Lisa Rodriguez, a round-faced local with gray-streaked hair and a calm, unblinking demeanor. Throughout the pandemic, she had run a daycare with the same name out of her home 10 minutes away in Del Valle. Now with a growing wait list, she was looking to open a new location. Rodriguez had put up the billboard, taken a selfie in front of it, and sent the photo to a few family members. I didn't do anything else, she told me. The sign was all the advertising I needed. Rodriguez, along with about half of all Americans, lives in a child care desert. A designation for an area that has more than three children below the age of five for each available child care spot. Parents in child care deserts have few options. They can put their children on wait lists, which can take anywhere from a few months to more than a year to clear. They can enlist the help of relatives or hire someone's grandma. Or they can stay home. Though in Texas, which ranks 43rd in the country for child well-being, this is all but impossible for parents of the nearly 1.5 million children who live in poverty. In the early days of 2023, not long after Rodriguez took her selfie, Amariah Harp was detouring around traffic on the 71 when she passed the sign for the joyful child. Harp, who lived about 20 minutes down the road and ran a volunteer animal shelter in Austin, had planned carefully for parenthood, building a comfortable life with a lucrative job at a construction company after divorcing her husband more than a decade earlier. Just months before spotting Rodriguez's advertisement, she had adopted her first child. Harp knew that hard work and sleepless nights were part and parcel of parenting, but she hadn't anticipated the sheer impossibility of finding care. It was a wasteland, she told me. There was nothing out there. She had put her baby on wait lists at a number of other daycares, but openings for infants were scarce. She considered hiring a nanny, but worried that the cost would leave her in debt. Finally, Harp called her mother, who had recently retired, and asked for help. Her mother started driving in from Hutto, about 45 minutes away, every day. The arrangement was hardly ideal, Harp said, laughing at the understatement. When Harp saw the advertisement for the joyful child, she was cautiously optimistic. Her options were limited, but she wasn't so desperate that she would put her son just anywhere. She went home to do her research and found a video from a local newscast of Rodriguez pushing kids on a swing set in her backyard and singing to them in the classroom as they climbed all over her. She had this home-based daycare that had these really great online reviews, Harp told me. A true blessing for our family, one reviewer gushed on Google. The best school in the world, wrote another. One of the best decisions of our life. Harp reserved a spot for her son right away. A few months later, after a series of permit and construction delays, the new joyful child opened for business. Harp was thrilled. It was so much fun, another mother, a physicist who had recently moved from Germany, told me. It was play-based childcare. It was all play, all day. Rodriguez's team kept the kids outdoors as much as possible. They provided meals and diapers. They held Halloween celebrations and hosted events with local librarians. If you've been with a daycare for a little while, you come to trust them, Harp told me. You don't sit there and worry about your kids all day. When the opportunity came in 2024 to adopt her son's younger sister, Harp said yes. Part of my deciding factor, she said, was that Lisa's daycare could take them. From the outside, the joyful child seemed to be thriving. Rodriguez had a wait list of nearly 200 parents and was looking to hire more staff and expand. Despite the demand, she was in financial trouble. Rodriguez had been able to open the new daycare with the help of a state grant. She had expected to receive another, but it never came through. She started dipping into her own savings and supported the new center with earnings from her home daycare. "We kept borrowing," she said. "We took out a little bit from my husband's 401k. Finally, I said, we can't do this anymore. It's going to hurt us personally." On a Thursday night in November, a few weeks before Harp's son turned 2, Rodriguez sent an email to parents announcing that the new location would close at the end of December. Harp called a friend that night and broke down in tears. "I'm not a crying kind of person," she told me. "I just thought, I have 2 little kids. What am I going to do?" Let me try to explain to those who haven't experienced it the feeling of drop daycare. It's a feeling I became intimately familiar with in 2020 when the pandemic arrived not quite 4 months after the birth of my second child. It's the feeling of being interrupted mid-sentence or mid-stride. It's like being asked to pivot mid-air, having already picked up your foot. Of course, parents, mothers in particular, are made resilient by years of infant and child chaos. I recently found myself bragging to my older daughter that I had caught vomit in my hand countless times. So we pivot. We look out at the coming days or weeks or months and do our best to rearrange them. With repetition, however, the feeling gets heavier. Your babysitter calls in sick, or your daycare shuts down, perhaps permanently, and the feeling curdles into existential dread. The daily logistical lift of raising young children while working continues to chafe against expectations we have of modern parents. The cooking, the enrichment, the importance of the first few years. And even if you can surmount it, there remains the matter of footing the bill. If you are a college student in the United States, you likely don't live near your parents. It takes a village to raise a child, as the saying goes, but you will have to pay the village. For years, the increase in childcare costs has outpaced inflation. In 2018, the average annual cost of daycare for a toddler was the equivalent of $9,460 today. Last year, the average annual cost of childcare came to $13,128, about 10% of the median income of a married couple, and more than a third of the median income of a single parent. In big cities, $13,128 might sound reasonable. In D.C., the average annual cost of infant care is $28,356. In New York City, where I live, although the average annual cost is $26,000 for center-based care, families can easily pay $600 per week for 5 full days, upwards of $30,000 per year. The Montessori School in Soho, which defines a full day's childcare as 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., charges nearly $45,000 a year. One mother I know has decided to work from home while caring for her youngest, since the nearest outpost of Bright Horizons costs more than $4,000 per month. And this is all assuming that a family can find childcare to begin with. Over the past decade, the number of home-based daycares, like Rodriguez's, has declined by about 25%. And while the number of larger daycare centers has modestly increased, childcare slots in the country still fall short by around 4.2 million. Daycares are highly regulated and expensive to operate. Even with tuition rates high and climbing, many providers are barely staying afloat amid increasing costs for insurance and labor, as well as general inflation. For many providers, profit margins hover around or below 1%. Rodriguez has kept her daycares relatively affordable. She did not strategically place them in affluent areas and is mindful of her clients' budgets. The region's population and economy are growing, however, while access to good childcare is limited. even here, daycare operators struggle to make ends meet. We tend to talk about our shifting domestic ideals as though they exist in a vacuum. The napdress version of domesticity sold by trad wives and maha moms is compelling because the alternatives are compromised by a failing system. Without institutional support, parents are left with a narrative of drudgery, one that equates children with the loss of time, money, and opportunity. During the pandemic, more than half of U.S. parents reported having changed their jobs or their working hours in order to care for their children. Things have hardly improved. Disruptions in childcare are responsible for billions of dollars in lost revenue each year. Kids get sick, daycares open and close, jobs are inflexible. I certainly wasn't prepared for the full days of work I would lose to, among other things, a rolling lice infestation. Parents who can lose days to lice and come out economically unscathed are lucky. Most families need two incomes to make ends meet, and most need childcare in order to work. Without a solution that enables childcare providers and parents alike to do so, the labor and expense of having children will continue to be crippling, if not outright prohibitive, for many. Lisa Rodriguez describes her approach to teaching as a philosophy of yes. She's an admirer of the Reggio Emilia schools founded in Italy following World War II, which emphasize a child-led approach to daily activities. At her home daycare, Del Valle, she keeps tables stocked with art supplies, sand, rolls of paper, and pipe cleaners, which she calls loose parts, and sees what her students do with them. As she showed a prospective parent around the backyard this past February, Rodriguez was tailed by a tiny white dog with mud on its paws and a sticker affixed to its butt. On another day, the children dug up worms and collected them in a bucket as they waited for their parents to pick them up. One child, showing a teacher his catch, called them chicken worms. "I think chickens like to eat them," he said. "Good thinking," she replied. Rodriguez opened her first home daycare in 1994 to earn money while staying home with her young children. This worked well until her children started attending public school and their schedules fell out of sync with her job. You think, be your own boss, make your own hours. "It's not that at all," she told me. Rodriguez closed the daycare and went on to work for the local school district, earning a degree in psychology, while working in special education and then at the district's Child Development Center, formulating strategies for kids who struggled with discipline or classwork. In 2017, when all her children had finished school, she decided to reopen her home daycare. She chose to return to the business because there were so few childcare options in the area. She wanted hers to be inclusive, flexible, and capable of identifying the many learning and developmental difficulties she had seen kids struggle with when she worked for the school district. Rodriguez felt this was her calling. When she first reopened her doors, she primarily served children of local teachers. Then, when the pandemic hit and schools closed, the Texas Workforce Commission, TWC, an agency that subsidizes childcare scholarships for low-income families, extended this aid to essential workers. Rodriguez agreed to provide childcare for these families, and her name was entered into a state-run database of providers. People from beyond Del Valle started calling. The joyful child was soon designated a 4-star provider, the highest possible rating in Texas Rising Star, a program overseen by the TWC. Rodriguez made a point of enrolling subsidized students, children with disabilities, and those whose parents required flexible or part-time schedules, though she had trouble taking kids whose parents worked at the nearby Tesla plant where shifts often started at 6 a.m. As Rodriguez's home daycare grew, she began considering expansion. She'd heard that Little Sprouts, a childcare center that had been renting space in Grace Reformed Baptist Church on FM 969, had been racking up bad reviews on Yelp. One parent reported overhearing a teacher tell a kid to sit your little ugly ass down. Another reviewer mentioned rats. Rodriguez was a regular congregant at the church and inquired about taking over the space if Little Sprouts left. The church said yes. At first, the expansion seemed like a success story, a well-regarded local provider growing with the help of both the community and the state. Rodriguez was awarded 2 startup grants by the TWC. The first, at $45,000, would enable her to expand her home daycare by adding a room to the side of her house. The second, a $95,000 award, would help fund renovations for the decaying church space, making the bathroom accessible, building a fence around the backyard, and getting rid of any pests. Once her second location was up and running, Rodriguez would be eligible to apply for a third grant, the initial operating award, helping her through its first year. But progress was slow. Rodriguez faced a never-ending stream of bureaucratic demands, from a building permit to an inspection by the fire marshal, before she could finally complete a child care inspection with Texas Health and Human Services in mid-November, just before the center opened. This was weeks after the deadline to qualify for the third grant. Rodriguez found herself responsible for paying the monthly expenses of caring for around 30 infants and toddlers, including the salaries of one director and 6 other staff members, without state assistance. By mid-2024, she had no choice but to raise the monthly cost of attendance from $1,200 to $1,300. To break even, she told me she would have needed to charge $1,500. In Texas, the true cost of infant care is an estimated $1,757 a month, accounting for payroll, facility expenses, legal and business expenses, and educational materials. Rodriguez, with a revenue of $25,500 a month, was paying $10,500 in rent and around $16,500 in payroll, and then still had utilities, insurance, and supplies such as food, diapers, and wipes to cover. To keep the lights on, she redirected revenue from her home daycare and refused to draw her own salary. Even without rent or renovation, a daycare's margins are slim. Infant rooms in particular bleed money owing to additional staffing demands. Fewer teachers are needed as kids get older, but filling those seats takes time, since families usually keep their children in the daycares they start with. Rodriguez had a permit to care for roughly 50 kids in the church. At capacity, she could have brought in around $15,000 a week or $60,000 a month. She hoped to eventually enroll more than 100 kids, which would require additional licensing. The challenge was to grow fast enough to accommodate the number of kids she needed to make a profit without the cushion of the operational grant. Rodriguez knew that she would be operating at a loss unless she added older student classrooms, which would entail hiring new teachers and operating at a greater loss as the classrooms filled up. She wrote numerous emails to the TWC requesting reconsideration of her grant denial, but was repeatedly refused. She asked the church to lower her rent and was likewise turned down. She contacted her state representative and an advocacy organization called the Texas Licensed Child Care Association, TLCCA, neither of which could provide any meaningful assistance. By the end of 2024, just 1 year after opening and faced with renewing her lease, Rodriguez decided to shut down her second location. She composed her announcement in a rush. "It is with a heavy heart that I share the news of our child care program's upcoming closure," the email read. "This decision was not made lightly, and we understand the impact it will have on you and your family." At certain moments in U.S. history, a comprehensive child care system seemed possible. During World War II, a network of subsidized child care centers served an estimated 550,000 children while their mothers worked. When the war ended and the program shut down, Eleanor Roosevelt protested in her syndicated newspaper column, "We have to face the fact that there are married women with young children who have to go to work," she wrote. "In such cases, it would seem to be in the interests of the community to organize child care centers and see that they are properly run." A second moment came on the heels of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, in the thick of feminism's second wave. An early version of the Comprehensive Child Development Act, CCDA, had been drafted by Walter Mondale in 1969 to expand on the Head Start program, which was established in 1965. It was rewritten with Representative John Perdamus of Indiana and supported by a coalition of interest groups that included the Children's Defense Fund and the National Organization for Women. The bill would have established a federally funded, universal system of child care for 3 and 4-year-olds, charging families on a sliding scale. The Washington Post called it a vehicle for a new national effort to make childhood livable. Enactment of the CCDA seemed at the time a sure thing. In 1971, it passed in the Senate, 63 votes to 17, as well as in the House of Representatives, 211 to 187. But President Nixon vetoed the bill, citing the threat it posed to the traditional family unit. He would not, he wrote in an impassioned letter to the Senate, commit the vast moral authority of the national government to the side of communal approaches to child rearing over against the family-centered approach. The next day, Nixon signed into law a different bill that expanded tax deductions for dependent care, specifically for families in which both parents were working or looking for work. When Nixon blocked the CCDA, just over 40% of American women participated in the workforce. This number, however, was climbing. Second wave feminists advocated for women's right to lead lives extending beyond the home. Women were also feeling the pressures of a changing economy. During the 70s, skyrocketing oil prices and rampant inflation paired with stagnant growth to diminish purchasing power. Corporations started to move manufacturing outside the United States, and labor arrangements that had been negotiated in the 30s and 40s, wherein a unionized worker might stay at one company for an entire career, drawing a pension and benefits, were eroding. Waged work became more unreliable, making the single-earner household increasingly unrealistic. At the same time, the service sector, which traditionally skewed female, was growing rapidly. 3/5 of the jobs created between 1976 and 1985 went to women. Women were working both because they were able and because they had to. And as more of them entered the workforce, the demand for childcare went up. From the mid-70s to the early 90s, the number of children enrolled in daycare grew by some 3 million. The number of workers employed in the child care industry more than tripled. But even in the 70s and 80s, child care was hard to come by and workers were poorly compensated. The market never really worked. Today, child care in the United States is the most expensive it's ever been. While federal funding for programs that support care and subsidize families, such as the Child Care and Development Block Grant or temporary assistance for needy families, has occasionally increased, a national program on the order of the CCDA has been conspicuously absent. The closest we've come was during the pandemic, when money from Biden's American Rescue Plan kept many providers afloat. Most of these funds, however, expired in 2023, and while the Biden administration initially included more permanent child care funding in its 2021 Build Back Better proposal, that part of the package ultimately fell apart. 4 years later, a federal solution couldn't seem further away. Lisa Rodriguez is not the only child care operator in Texas who is squeezed between high operating costs and the limited budgets of parents. On a chilly morning in February, While Rodriguez was busy receiving arriving kids, a group of child care operators gathered at the Texas State Capitol to testify before the Senate Finance Committee. "Legislators don't understand what they're doing to our industry," Tim Kaminsky, the president of the TLCCA, one of the advocacy organizations to which Rodriguez had appealed for help, told me, "unless we're here explaining the business side of it." Alongside his mother, Kaminsky is the co-owner of the Gingerbread Kids Academy, a large center on the outskirts of Houston. He is a registered Republican with a fondness for plaid shirts and a schedule packed with rallies and legislative hearings. At the Capitol that day, the agenda included the TWC's budget proposal for the next fiscal year. Kaminsky was hoping to use the session as an opportunity to encourage the Senate to allocate more money to the TWC's subsidy program and thereby shorten its 95,000 child waitlist. He also wanted to ask the TWC to increase subsidy payments to meet market rates. The TWC, according to the daycare owners I spoke with, is notorious for late payments, and it offers providers only about 75% of projected child care costs, though the amount varies geographically. Kaminsky had invited me to meet him at the Capitol Grill, the building's cafeteria, where I arrived to find a group of 10 men gathered at a circular table. "Probably the women were busy running the centers," Rodriguez joked me later. The group waved me over and introduced themselves. Sitting next to me were a former NFL defensive back who had invested his football earnings in a chain of daycares and a Halliburton employee turned daycare owner. Two others had come to the industry after white-collar jobs in healthcare. These were people both interested in serving their community and expecting to turn a profit. The group discussed the dire state of affairs as they waited to be called to the hearing. James Ihedigbo, the former NFL player, said that he had recently purchased property with the intent to develop another child care center. "No way I'm doing that now," he joked. "We're doing a gas station." Later he asked whether anyone at the table was interested in nursing homes. The group that had gathered that day were, for the most part, franchise owners. In Texas and across the country, many new centers are part of larger national franchises, Kids or Kids, Primrose Schools, Kitty Academy. Each offers its own branded curriculum, along with varying levels of support for owners. Some even provide guidelines for the layout of facilities. There are also Reggio Emilia, Waldorf, and Montessori schools, the latter of which are famously favored by Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. Home daycares, like Rodriguez's, tend to be cheaper and more flexible, warmer, she says, than these centers, but they lack their scale and uniformity. The child care operators at the table charge prices ranging from around $200 a week to more than $300. "It depends partly on the neighborhood," they explained. "It's a math problem," said Sharon Perry, an owner who joined us later in the day. "We have staffing quotas, which drives up labor costs." Perry's insurance costs have increased fourfold since 2019, and her payroll expenses are up 35% from pre-pandemic levels. Worker turnover is high across the country, and everyone is trying to balance the costly infant rooms with more profitable ones for older children. Many daycares are constrained in the number of infants they take in, or simply can't accept students younger than 12 or 18 months old. "People get confused," Perry told me. "They think we're raking in the dollars. My building? It's a beautiful edifice, but that doesn't mean we're making money." When Kaminsky joined his mother's modest child care operation 17 years ago, he did his best to grow it, advertising widely and introducing an in-house after-school program. But he felt the landscape shift around him. Rents, insurance costs, and salaries ballooned. As it did for many providers across the nation, the American Rescue Plan kept his business afloat. "Without the ARPA funds," he told me, "we're not going to last another 2 years." At the same time, traditional public schools, also facing a decline in enrollment, began rolling out pre-K programs, cutting into Kaminsky's profits. But while these programs are cost-saving for parents lucky enough to secure a spot, for the for-profit daycare industry, they're competition. You are listening to the article, Growing Pains, Daycare's Affordability Crisis, by Lauren Hilgers, from the December 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. They just cut out 50% of our business, Kaminsky told me, the most lucrative part. In 2021, a bill passed in the Texas House of Representatives calling for a plan to stabilize the child care workforce in the state. The resultant working group recommended that the TWC develop a wage supplement or bonus plan for child care workers, requiring an investment of more than $2 billion. As it stands, the TWC's budget for local child care solutions is slightly more than $1.3 billion, but most of this is federally sourced. When an industry requires an influx of $2 billion, smaller measures can feel paltry. But Kaminsky and his cohort of owners have had a few minor victories. Last year, for instance, the state passed a bill to reduce property taxes for child care providers if at least 20% of the students they enroll receive subsidies. But to be able to accept children on subsidies, child care facilities must first qualify for the Texas Rising Star program, which requires time and money. You have to invest in getting the rating in order to qualify for more money from the state, Kevin Kilgore, the owner of Six Kids Are Kids franchises around Houston, told me. This tax break, moreover, is not granted automatically. Providers are required to apply for it, and the process can be confusing. One of Kilgore's centers, for example, enrolls the required portion of subsidized children, but has struggled to receive tax relief. He had recently hired a tax attorney to try and figure things out. The state's efforts, Kaminsky said, have done little to stem another phenomenon he has observed in his area, a tide of middle-class families dropping out of daycare entirely. This is a population not so easily accounted for, he said. They might not qualify for subsidies, but their child care costs, especially with more than one child, may be high enough that it makes more financial sense for one parent to stay home. And if piecemeal fixes fail to make child care affordable, neither do they succeed in making it lucrative for owners and workers. Today, 43% of U.S. child care workers rely on social assistance. Wages are so low that workers generally can't live on their salaries alone. At her home daycare, Rodriguez employs a group of teachers and caretakers who are, for the most part, either in their 20s and childless, or else parents with at least one child enrolled in the daycare. One employee, who was only 19 when I first visited, had moved on to a desk job in a storage facility by my second visit. Another teacher, a woman with a degree in early childhood education, told me that she lives with her parents. If I had to move out and pay those bills, no, I would not make it. What I'm getting now is still barely making it. In a better world, a universal program would ensure equal access to education and care. Expanded family leave would help cover the earliest and most expensive months of a child's life. Postpartum mothers might be granted medical leave in addition to paid parental leave. Partners might also be afforded leave, which would delay the need for children by 6 months or even a year. According to Catherine Ann Edwards, a labor economist, Medicaid could be expanded to help employers shoulder health insurance costs while employees are off caring for their children. In our less than ideal world, an administration that is preoccupied with birth rates rather than facilitating care is calling the shots. Having declared himself the fertilization president, Trump has promised the parents of U.S. citizens born between 2025 and 2028 a baby bonus of $1,000. He has also considered the idea, borrowed from the Soviet Union, of handing out medals to women with a large number of children. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act has proposed some modest increases in tax relief, expanding several programs while adding new limitations on eligibility. The child tax credit, for instance, was increased from a maximum of $2,000 to around $2,200 per qualifying child, although a large portion of this money is provided through refunds, limiting the benefit for low-income families. Again, none of this will do much to offset the cost of raising a young child. Moreover, these benefits come hand in hand with other measures that will likely cripple more comprehensive efforts to address the child care crisis. The Transportation Secretary has instructed his agency to give preference to communities with high birth rates so that new mothers might travel on well-funded highways. Meanwhile, temporary freezes and proposed cuts have drastically reduced the staff of programs, including Head Start and the Child Care and Development Fund. Trump's 2026 budget would significantly cut funding to departments that oversee various other federal child care programs and grants. This has left many states scrambling for their own solutions. A number of them, including Michigan, Ohio, and Kentucky, have turned to something called the tri-share model, in which employers, employees, and the state split the cost of childcare. But most of these programs limit access to the employees of participating companies. Other states have moved to expand access to publicly funded pre-K and even 3K programs, a strategy that lowers costs for parents but cuts into the profits and viability of the private daycare system, driving people like Kaminsky and Kilgore to show up at state budget meetings. The most ambitious child care plan in the country belongs to New Mexico, where, as of this November, every resident is guaranteed free access to child care. The state has established a framework for provider compensation based on real cost, ensuring that operators don't lose money when they take on subsidized kids. The expanded program that began this fall also includes salary requirements for childcare workers, starting at $18 an hour, higher than the national median wage of $15.41 for childcare workers, and a statewide recruitment drive to help fill worker shortages. But New Mexico is one of the few states with enough resources to fund such an ambitious program. Both the state's land-grant permanent fund, one of the largest in the country, with about $32 billion in assets, and Early Childhood Trust Fund, which is projected to end the year with $9 billion in assets, channel money from the state's mineral rights toward early childhood education. Other states, such as Vermont, are using payroll taxes to expand eligibility for child care subsidies. But few states have the oil and gas reserves of New Mexico or Vermont's appetite for additional taxation. Texas, as it happens, has its own permanent school fund written into the state constitution in 1845 and considerably larger than New Mexico's, with more than $60 billion in total assets. Last year, the fund distributed around $2.4 billion to K-12 schools across the state, but it seems unlikely that Texas will ever use the money to implement universal child care. This past spring, more than 2 years after the Texas Working Group proposed that the TWC add more than $2 billion to its budget, lawmakers finally agreed to an increase of $100 million for child care scholarships. "We are thankful that something has moved forward," Kaminsky told me. But, he added, the additional money will only take about 5,000 children off the wait list, which he expects will not keep pace with how fast it is growing. I made my first visit to Rodriguez's home daycare on a brisk day in February. Children were scattered around an ample yard in front of her house, some pushing toy trucks, others sitting at an arts and crafts table set up under an oak tree. A five-year-old in a penguin costume ran out to meet me, asking for my name before informing me officiously that I would not be the only Lauren there that day. A smaller girl walked up behind her and asked me if I would like a hug. As we moved toward the front door, yet another little girl tripped and fell across the walkway, scraping her hands. Before I could bend down to help, she started crying, and the penguin, her older sister, it turned out, grabbed my arm and told me, "When a little kid falls in front of you, you have to stop." She paused and regarded me with gravity as her sister wailed and a teacher inspected her scraped hands. "And then," she added, "you walk around them." When Rodriguez's second location closed, she was primarily concerned with finding arrangements for as many of the kids as she could. Some families hire teachers from the center to lead nanny shares, arrangements that can serve up to 3 kids and typically require teachers to work more than 8 hours a day. Others she brought to her home daycare. The day I visited, Rodriguez had 9 teachers working, many of whom had known one another for years, filtering in and out, chatting with the children, and supervising their activities. It couldn't last, she told me. She would have to expand again or reduce everyone's hours. It's hard when you find reliable early childhood educators to let them go. Rodriguez is fond of them. Many of her staff members deal with the same economic dilemmas as their clients. They need to work, and they want to work, but they want to be good mothers, too. Back in December, after hearing of the new center's closure, Amaria Harp had taken stock of her choices. The new baby was arriving that month, and Harp was granted a stretch of maternity leave during which she would try to figure it all out. She eventually found a place for her son at a daycare center not far from her home in Manor. By February, Harp was paying close to $900 a month to send him there just 2 days a week. "That's like rent," she said, laughing. When she returned to work in March, his days at the center increased, and the cost more than doubled. In the meantime, Harp had found an older woman in her neighborhood, the mother of one of Rodriguez's teachers at the shuttered center, to take care of the baby during the days. Harp pays her $1,200 a month. "And yes, I'll still be paying for diapers and formula and all that," she told me. Still, Harp feels lucky. She has an understanding boss, a good salary, and some flexibility in her schedule. If her son gets sick, she can stay home. She knows many parents who aren't so fortunate. Multiple friends have had to quit their jobs to care for their children. A couple had to move in with parents. A single mom, expecting an open seat for her child, lost it at the last minute. Luck, however, can't solve all the challenges of childcare. The daycare that Harp found was larger and more regimented than Rodriguez's free play home, and her son had trouble adjusting. For the first time, he was crying at drop-off. Teachers complained about behavior that Harp considered normal for a 2-year-old. "He takes his shoes off," she told me. "He doesn't like naps." After 2 months, Harp pulled him out. She called Rodriguez, who said that she'd be happy to take him, but that her home daycare was currently full. She reserved a seat for Harp's son come September. Harp would have to cobble things together. Until then. Lauren Hilgers is the author of Patriot No. 1. Her most recent article for Harper's Magazine, The Unraveling of Beausoleil, appeared in the March 2013 issue. Now I'll be reading the new books column with reviews by Dan Pippenbring. I could never work in real estate. Beyond my complete lack of salesmanship, I focused too much on the past. I would find it hard to present some condo, McMansion, or pied-à-terre as an opportunity rather than as a site of disappointment or decay. "Just so you know, this is the room the last tenant died in," I would tell my clients. Over their uneasy laughter, I'd invite them to consider our graceless coexistence with the dead, whom we routinely ignore, evict, unchurch, or otherwise trample on. We would all part ways feeling a bit cheated. In Spectralopolis, The Enchantment of Capital in Singapore, University of Minnesota Press, Joshua Kamaroff, a designer and professor, finds himself at the fraught junction of the haunted and the high-rise. For 20 years, Komarov has been living in Singapore, which boasts a coruscating, seemingly self-perpetuating skyline of screens, large paned glazing, and glossy spandrels seated in well-tempered tropical nature, he writes, with indoor rainforests, waterfalls, and linear parks spanning between skyscrapers. The island nation's state-of-the-art sprawl testifies to its ascent as a global financial hub, a place for oligarchs to shelter their wealth and speculate. And yet this sleek, antiseptic environment, a nation by design, a previous prime minister called it, where nothing was by chance, is overrun by ghosts. They're lost, they're hungry, and they need cash. Among Singapore's ethnic Chinese community, about 76% of the population, the district faiths Taoism and Buddhism have illegally married, one of Komarov's sources tells him, resulting in an elaborate cosmology in which spirits roam angry and confused, their memories of themselves withering from neglect by the living. Ghosts wield vast commercial power. Transacting with them can bring prosperity or ruin. In 2005, contractors helped work on one of Komarov's projects because a single room appeared to refuse demolition. Bulldozer drivers were stricken with an odd malady, like the effects of radiation sickness. As is apparently standard procedure in such situations, the workers put down their tools until a medium interceded with the appropriate offerings. Thus was Komarov, an American raised in Chicago, initiated into the rituals of Singapore's spectro-economy, as he calls it. Citizens commune not just with deceased relatives, but with the undifferentiated mass of anonymous dead. Much of this communion involves setting stuff on fire. Ignition serves as the point of sale between our world and Diu, or the Earth Prison, a hellish realm overlaying our own, with graduated levels of suffering and a robust bureaucracy. Hell, like Singapore, is a very expensive place, Komarov writes, comparing it to a venal entrepot whose officials and guards can be bribed for better conditions and accommodations. By burning miniature paper replicas or kimzua of houses, KFC franchises, cars, smartphones, Hermes shirts, hired help, pets, COVID vaccines, and fake money or hell notes, one transmits these objects to the black market of the afterlife, where the dead can use them to get ahead, much as inmates traffic in cigarettes and ramen. Some offerings reflect the idea that the dead exist in the future. Go ahead, burn a paper iPhone 25. They've already got that model. Artisans design customized kimzua, but it's more affordable to visit kimzua.com.sg, where one can purchase, say, a small maquette of a Mercedes G-Class for 13.50 Singapore dollars, about 10 American. Watch it burn to ashes. A Revenant SUV has just parked itself in purgatory. If you don't know your ghost's consumer preferences, it's best to send cash. Hell notes are widely available at local shops, markets, and online. Many of them resemble U.S. currency. They're backed by the Central Bank of Hell and adorned with images of a gigantic and somewhat nondescript pagoda, or else an American federal-style megalith that advertises itself, in at least one case, as the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the location of the Infernal Mint, in Komarov's estimate. The denominations of hell notes can often run to eight figures, though their face value has little bearing on their earthly price, which can be as low as a few cents. Inflation is so high, a property developer tells Komarov, hell is worse than Zimbabwe now. Well-remunerated spirits will reinvest their capital on Earth, bringing about dramatic changes of fortune. During Ghost Month, the seventh month of the Chinese lunisolar calendar, auctioneers sell seemingly ordinary items, backpacks, calculators, tchotchkes, imbued with a spiritual charge thought to bring good luck. Singapore's gamblers have long been known to visit cemeteries in the dead of night to divine winning lottery numbers. and these practices are hardly the sole domain of the hoi polloi. There's an ardent interest in haunted commodities, Kamaroff writes, among fund managers, venture capitalists, and crypto bros. Even the least superstitious Singaporeans take pains to ensure their investments against supernatural disturbance. On a construction site for an ultra-high-end apartment building, Kamaroff once witnessed a two-hour purification ceremony led by a chain-smoking medium who paced the property barefoot despite the broken glass and debris scattered about. The medium brought fruit, flowers, a bag of rice, a bottle of water, thimble-sized cups of tea and brandy, and a sacred hammer swathed in red ribbon. He lit blazes of hell notes, chanted, and fell into a trance. Eventually, to signal the property's successful purgation, he climbed into an excavator surrounded by fire and started its engine. Spectropolis is never glib about the transparent profit motive sustaining such rites, nor does it unduly exoticize Eastern religion. The West has seen its own spectro-economics, Kamaroff writes, as when 19th century clairvoyants held seances to pick stocks. For its part, Singapore has been aggressively retrofitted according to the whims of capital. Its coastline expanded, its graveyards exhumed and paved over, its landmarks destroyed, leaving the populace disoriented. The nation's soaring growth feels spooky, derived as it is from abstruse financial instruments. Today, Kamaroff writes, there is always a proprietary Excel spreadsheet based on quasi-occult mathematical formulas that purports to tame chance for its users and not for all the others. Given such aleatory conditions, bartering with spirits may seem like a sensible way to manage risk and anxiety, though humankind will always make ghosts faster than we can make peace with them. One realtor told Kamaroff that she struggles to sell homes built as recently as the early aughts. People think they're so old, haunted already. Bothersome ghosts can be bought off or sent packing. What can you do, though, if you're haunted by a tedious old man, a flesh and blood pedant? He may appear suddenly at your side, unwashed, pallid, ready to dilate for hours on a Hegel. Ritual offerings won't sway him. You've got to just let him blow. Pedants are overwhelmingly men. Arnou S.Q. Visser, a professor of textual culture at Utrecht University, writes in On Pedantry, A Cultural History of the Know-It-All, Princeton University Press. This much I knew. Accordingly, the pedant's reception operates as an index of masculinity, fluctuating over time. Whereas mansplainers, in Visser's view, seem to suffer from an excess of testosterone, a 1956 Newsweek report on eggheads accused them of being over-emotional and feminine in reactions to any problem. You'll never meet the same pedant twice. His identity reflects shifting concerns about the cultural role of the intellectual and the purpose of higher education. Under Visser's big tent are not just sticklers and top lofty grammarians, but all the insufferably learned, sophists and cynics, salonniers and savants and scholastics, Grub Street strivers and nutty professors, quarrelsome clerks and captious theologians. He returns almost compulsively to the word irritation, which has been the pedant's stock in trade since even before the Lyceum opened its doors. Socrates was known in his time to be ugly and irritating. Visser writes, with the face of a satyr and the appearance of a beggar. The 4th century's Cassian of Imola, patron saint of shorthand writers and court reporters, and apparently a strict teacher, was so irritating that a judge condemned him to be tortured to death by his own students, who stabbed him with their styli and school supplies. Pedants themselves can become irritated. Lucubration is hard on the body. Isaac Casaubon, the French philologist, whose name apparently inspired that of the bone-dry Casaubon of Middlemarch, hid the book so diligently that his bladder became aggravated by sedentary habits, his biographer wrote, and inattention to the calls of nature. Visser's glosses on the ancients and medievals are interesting, but it's not until the Renaissance that we meet Il Pedante proper, a stereotype of the stage, where he's always overusing Latin, behaving boorishly at table, etc. The Stable Master, a 1533 comedy by Pietro Aretino, features a character called the Pedant, a soup slipper, bean eater, lasagna pit, who is urged to speak plainly. All this, ibus ibas, business is too constipated for us. As humanist scholars gained cachet, they provoked fear. Maybe their endless specialization was taking them farther from God's wisdom instead of closer to it. They faced charges of vanity, pretension, effeminacy, sodomy, pederasty. They were low-born, upwardly mobile fuss budgets trying to read their way into the aristocracy. Their persons smelled of the shop, their writing of the lamp. By the late 1600s, Ulrich Huber, a Frisian law professor, had settled on a definition of pedantry as learning that is corrupted by arrogance, feigned virtue, and impertinent judgment. But what constitutes corruption? Just about everything, in times of inflamed anti-intellectualism. Huber feared that even men far from the academy, including physicians, lawyers, ministers, senators, noblemen, indeed kings and rulers, and whoever likes to be regarded as partaking in learning, had succumbed to the ways of the pedant. The pulpit, in particular, came under attack for bookish ostentation because, as one preacher proclaimed, when the Lord wanted to blow down the walls of Jericho, he didn't take a brass trumpet or a polished French horn. He took a ram's horn, a plain natural ram's horn. And so, when he wants to blow down the walls of the spiritual Jericho, my beloved brethren and sisters, he don't take one of your smooth, polite, college-learned gentlemen, but a plain, natural, ram's horn sort of man like me. We have run out of time. Thanks so much for listening to this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the December 2025 issue. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.